Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome to the On Point Podcast. This is your host, Luke Elshoff, a first year hailing from Region 8 based in NCFCA. This is a weekly podcast where I'll have a guest on the show and cover something in speech or debate. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome back to the On Point Podcast. Today I'm joined by Caleb Brown and we're going to be discussing a number of things, mostly dealing with argument selection, debate personas, and your narratives. Now, Caleb has done NCFCA for 5 years. He's competed in moot court, team policy, in a total of 7 speech categories. He's won several tournaments in extemporaneous. He's been to finals at tournaments several times in apologetics and various platforms. He's been to finals several times in team policy. This past year, he had a 50% finals appearance rate. He won Region 12 regionals and a mixer. He's gotten several speaks awards, including 2 wins. He's done moot court for 3 years. He's won a tournament there. He's been nationally ranked all 3 years, including 3rd this year, and won 2 Speaks Awards at tournaments this year. And he's also been competing in Coolidge for 2 years. He's advanced at the Cup, and he won 1st place and 1st place Speaks at qualifying tournaments this season. That's a lot, and thank you so much for joining me today, Caleb.
Thank you very much.
Great. Now, you are a senior who graduated, right?
Technically a super senior, but yes.
Super senior. That makes more sense, because whenever I see you, I'm like, is that person really an NCFCA? And I think a lot of people actually have that thought.
Yeah.
So what are your plans now that you're officially done with high school and NCFCA?
I'll probably be attending Liberty University online for a couple semesters, working several jobs. After that, I don't know. It could be anything from law school to, I could do continuing debate basically and do foreign policy. I don't know. We'll just see.
Great. That's cool. So in terms of debate throughout these years, did you have like a consistent or towards the end of it, did you create like a sort of debate philosophy that you would follow throughout your debates? Do you have anything of that sort?
I think it's probably kind of merged and molded itself a little bit over the years. And it's probably also kind of broad. I'd say my philosophy, I think, would consist of 2 things. As far as like theory goes, like when you think of like a judge philosophy, I don't know. It's pretty normal. I'm a student of theory. I don't profess to know it all. I'm still learning a lot. We've actually had a lot of people in our region, for instance, like Daniel Miller, et cetera, that have challenged my views of theory. So that's one side. As far as the other side, though, of philosophy, I think I could frame it like as an approach to debating. I think there's a couple things, but I don't know. It just depends. Our approach to debating has kind of been unique in that I've had the same partner all 5 years. He's my brother, Seth. We're very close. But the approach has been, I don't know, sometimes it feels like it's non-existent. We just kind of ad hoc and do things and just roll with it in rounds. So it just kind of depends. Literally, it changes between tournaments, between seasons, etc.
So whatever works best for you in the moment?
Basically, yes.
That's great. So for argument selection, would you say that there's like a significance to it? Obviously, a very broad question, but take with it what you will.
I think I would say I would divide my answer probably into like looking at affirmative and negative, not necessarily because the way that you should approach it is different, but just because there's, with negative at least, generally you have to have a bit more flexible or at least several different ways of selecting arguments, especially if you're without a brief. As far as being affirmative goes, I think the thing that has helped us most is 2 things. 1, pursuing cases and corresponding sub-arguments that you like genuinely enjoy. For instance, one of the things that hooked Seth and I basically all 5 years that we competed was we first started in the terrorism year in team policy, and we developed kind of a morbid fascination with a particular terrorist group called Hezbollah, and many of our cases have since revolved around that theme. Or for instance, the case that we dealt with last year, we ran dredging primarily, concerned in many cases like actual ports in our own state. So that's the first thing, is like selecting cases and arguments that I think you like really, really find enjoyable. Secondarily, though, is probably selecting arguments, at least on affirmative, that are like memorable, because often debates can be really, really boring on affirmative. And I think like the cases I dread the most hitting negative are not necessarily the good cases. They're just like the tariff cases or like the purely economics cases that are really boring.
Right.
So for this past year, like on dredging, we ran a particular, I don't know, kind of like an application or argument where there's this thing where in the Port of Houston, the channel is so narrow that the ships literally play like chicken to get through it. So you'll have like massive container ships that are like barely avoiding each other or sometimes don't avoid each other and they'll collide. And we would challenge our opponents to respond to that particular analogy. Most of the time they didn't, even though they ran, you know, good other arguments. And then in the 2AR, I got to come back and be like, look, Judge, that memorable thing of like container ships playing high-speed chicken, then we respond to it. So like look for things like that are like picturesque in the judge's mind. As far as negative goes, I think you should also have things that are memorable. But I think our general process for negative is kind of just whatever we think is most correct. So we may have entire briefs that are solely disadvantages. We may have briefs that are almost exclusively heavy on significance, but not so much disadvantages. We may have things that are entirely solvency. We just generally try to pick things that we at least believe are like as genuinely accurate as they can and let the arguments dictate the rest.
Great. Well, you mentioned that making your arguments more memorable, and what would be one way to do that? So it would be like making analogies surrounding arguments, making examples or illustrating a specific thing that's going on in the debate and showing that to the judge so that the judge can pair the argument with the analogy or example. Is that what you mean?
I think partially that's one way to do it. I would say, though, that there's a bit of a difference between giving interesting, almost stories about the current situation versus an analogy. So for instance, the Texas chicken is a real thing. You know, obviously negatives can argue whether it's attributed to dredging, but it's real. I will say, as far as analogy goes, perhaps some of the best advice I've ever heard on that came from a team. They were very good in our region, but they strongly disliked using analogies, not necessarily dramatic examples, but analogies. And the reason being that they gave, and it's pretty good, is you can always flip an analogy in debates really easily. So one of the things that I dislike the most is teams that will open with like a stock sort of analogy, right? And it usually yeah. isn't that applicable. It's sometimes kind of cheesy, but you can always flip those so easily. So you have to be careful with just running pure analogies.
Right. So you said that partially that's one of the ways. I apologize if I misheard. What would be like the other side of it? You mentioned that analogies can be flipped. So in order to make an argument more memorable, analogies is one part, and examples, that's one part of it. So what would be like the other side of it?
I think the other way to make arguments memorable isn't necessarily the argument itself so much as like the way you deliver it. And this is something that Seth and I don't know that we specialize in, but like we're known in our region for being kind of like the weirdos, I guess. So we will deliver arguments in, sometimes we'll be very funny about it. Sometimes we'll be very blunt, like we've been compared to Trump in debate rounds. Just things like that. So for instance, my brother this past year, we were against the sugar tariff case. And we were running, I don't know if you know about it, the obesity argument. If you lower the tariffs, Americans will consume more sugar, they'll be fat, you can impact that a lot of different ways. And Seth, to make it memorable, would literally lampshade his argument by joking about fat people and how he was glad that the judges weren't fat. And that's how he would like intro his argument. And we would have people rolling on the floor, and they may or may not buy the argument, but they at least remember Seth's delivery of it.
Right. I'm sure that argument could only apply to certain rounds.
Yes, it could. Yes.
So with argument selection, one aspect is how you deliver the arguments, but another aspect of it is also what arguments you pick. So would you say that you should value quantity over quality in certain instances of argument selection?
I think I generally don't prefer quantity if you're looking at it on the end of the spectrum that's basically like speed and spread, yeah. similar to like public school debate in some cases. I don't really generally appreciate that. That being said, though, sometimes Seth and I will do things close to that, but they're like almost micro arguments. So for instance, if we're critiquing a study, we may throw out 8 different things that we want the AF to prove about that study. They're just hyper-specific details. But generally speaking, we only have, 3 or 4 arguments of speech. One of the things that I found very weird is opponents, whether they're affirmative and it's their own backup, or whether it's negative, and they'll have, 40, 60-page briefs. I don't understand that, because you can never physically read that into a round. Almost all of our affirmative backups and neg briefs, our AFs are basically under 10 pages. Our neg briefs are usually only 3 or 4. So we try to prioritize quality much higher.
Right. What about this, though? During the negative block, would you find it somewhat as a strategy in order to fill in a lot of arguments so that whenever the affirmative team has to come up to respond to all those arguments, and then inevitably they will be dropping 1 or 2 there? Do you ever find yourself doing that? And if not, is that why you prioritize quality over quantity?
We generally don't. The only times that we will do that is twofold. One is if we're neck without a brief and the AF has kind of backed us into a corner. And at that point, we're we'll just light off as much as we can. And secondarily, building off of that, the only time from that we'll do it is not that we just fill the block with dumb arguments, because that's purposeless, and I don't want that to be our reputation. But what we will do is fill it with a ton of logical arguments. We'll try to very selectively read their evidence, look at every little last detail that they are reading in the underlying portions, things like that. And if you know enough about logic and you have enough experience in debate, you can fill a lot of time with still good arguments, but they're primarily logical.
Right. So with arguments, another aspect of argument selection is simplifying those arguments. So what would you say are some different ways of simplifying arguments, and when should you utilize them, if not always?
I think, generally speaking, I'll start with the last part of your question. Generally, you want them to be as simple as you can, unless you're building... The only time that our arguments wouldn't be simple is if, for instance, our entire 1AC is just one meta-argument, and so we're having to very carefully unpack it. And then it may be, several subpoints, all those kinds of things. Generally, though, I would agree you want them simple. The ways that Seth and I usually try to make them simple are, a couple fold. One is kind of going back to what you said earlier. I think personality in the delivery of the argument is almost as important as the content. So making it very approachable, down to earth, we often use a lot of jokes in our round, although not necessarily. If our judge is more stone-faced or reserved, just being excruciatingly simple sometimes. We had this one judge who, I don't know what she was going through that day, but we could just tell it was going to be a very difficult round if we did not explain it well. And this was back in the energy year. And so the case was about renewable fuel standards. I don't know if you know it or not, but basically mandating that ethanol needs to go into gas. So by the end of the round, our approach to delivering the arguments was something as simple as we grow corn, put in gas station, in your car. That's bad. Stop that. So it just depends on your judge. The other thing I would say too, though, is simplifying your rhetoric around an argument. Because teams will, and this is partially related to impacting, but teams will use really complicated language, and I've done this at times too, to explain really simple things, especially in the realm of theory. For instance, topicality and impacting it. People will give all different kinds of ways that they'll explain it, and sometimes don't impact it at all, sometimes the impacts are really poor. But making sure that you literally just break it down into simple subpoints, a warrant, etc., where they fail at the violation, and then having 1 or 2 very clear impacts is something that's not usually seen, I think, in this league. And then the last thing that Seth and I use, at least, and again, this depends on the team, it works with us sometimes in specific circumstances with judges when there's the right kind of energy in a room, is just being really blunt. So, for instance, when Seth ran that sugar argument, just completely removing any stigma in the room. Yo, we're glad you're not a fat judge, okay? Or, sometimes we will, we were trying to demonstrate a very particular point against one of our opponents in semifinals at regionals, the very technical argument that they were running. It basically dealt with how consumers were aware of a very particular tariff that had lapsed. And so we just started asking them about their shopping trip in CX. We would ask them, you know, basically, how do you shop Walmart? Is that the same way as normal people do? And obviously, a team policy debater is going to do things when they're shopping at Walmart that normal people won't understand, especially after this year. So just using very blunt, very approachable ways of calling out things or describing things.
Great. And those are some great responses. So just to kind of like summarize, one way to do it is just like your personality and how you deliver the argument itself. Another one is just simplifying the rhetoric, not using fancy, elaborate language in order to illustrate a simple point. And then last of all, you mentioned how we should be blunt and straight to the point. Sometimes if it does work and if it feels good, is that kind of accurate of what you mentioned?
I think so. The only thing I would add is when you're talking about simplifying language, some people think of that just in the context of don't use a ton of debate jargon. And it means like more than that, like down to the grammar of your sentence and down to just like how you're analyzing the situation. So if I'm talking about, I don't know, like I'll go back 5 years. There was this case where the affirmative was planning on designating the Houthi rebels down in Yemen as a foreign terrorist organization. Okay. The negative team, they're very good speakers. They were some of our mentors. They're good debaters. They don't use jargon. That's not the problem. But what they come up and they're trying to make an argument is that if you designate this terrorist group as being an actual terrorist group, they're going to retaliate because they have access through piracy and whatnot to disrupt a bunch of oil shipping in the region. That is obviously bad because the United States is still at least somewhat dependent on Middle Eastern oil.
Right.
But the way that they analyzed it was they were like, and they tagged it as like disrupting hydrocarbons. None of us in the audience knew what that meant. And unless you work in the energy sector and you're some dad judging, you also don't know what that means. So it means everything down to just not like terminology, like stock issues and jargon and tagging, but also just the basic grammar that you're using to describe it.
Right. And are there like certain instances in debate where informal language is acceptable?
That is one of the things that is kind of like a hallmark of Seth and I think. We're not the only team in the NCFC that does it, but we're one of the few in our region. Our region is kind of very serious and almost stilted somewhat. I think it depends on several things. One, this is, at least in my experience, true, if not somewhat sexist. It is very difficult for girls to pull it off, okay? Informal language or just actions in general. Now, I've seen some girls pull it off. Like there was this one girl, she was incredibly good 5 years ago. She would literally wear her sunglasses on her head, like in semis, at tournaments, because she had that much swag. Most people can't. So I think it depends, generally speaking, and it depends on your region. I think part of it is a gender thing. Second, it's a judge thing. Seth and I are funny in a lot of rounds, but we're not funny in all rounds. If there's a dad or someone who's very, you know, stern or whatnot, if there's a community who's confused, we won't be funny in those times. And it also depends on the vibe of the room. I feel that jokes and using informal language or, I don't know, like Seth said bruh to one of our opponents at Nationals and CX, stuff like that. I think it works better in out rounds because all of the competitors generally know who you are, especially at the regional level. Most of them hopefully are at least somewhat rooting for you, or at least both teams. And laughter in being informal and all that is so much more powerful than.
Right. Now, I want to bring us back a little bit to like the question about like simplifying arguments. I think like another aspect of that is like generalizing arguments and also just like grouping arguments. So what's your take about that? Is it a good idea to like group arguments, or should you just be more line by line and methodical in your approach to argument selection?
That's a really good question. I have seen it done both ways. There was a debater in our region who would literally flip rounds because she was so good at having a more general big picture. And she didn't never said it in her 2AR, but the implication was these are the most important arguments. She wasn't trashing the negatives, other ones that she didn't get to. You could just, there was like a gravitas about her that was like, these are the most important. And judges usually bought that.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, Seth and I aren't as good at doing that, and we're very line by line. As far as generalizing arguments or grouping them, I mean, common sense just dictates if you're going to group something, it better be accurate and you're not just trying to like cover up things in the 1 hour, especially, you know, make sure that you're actually grouping stuff that's appropriate, or the negative will just come back and give you three additional responses to respond to. So I think it just depends. If you're actually correct in your analysis, then it shouldn't be a problem.
Right. And now I'm kind of going to like flip the switch over to some other things that we're going to be discussing. So that was argument selection, and you had some really good insights on that. So as far as debate personas and also just narratives, they're two kind of separate things, but they do share some similar characteristics in the sense that it's much more, I don't want to say like storytelling, but it's a little bit different than traditional just going down the flow by argument and argument and argument, line by line type methodical approach, as I mentioned earlier. But they are still different things. So tell me a little bit about debate personas and narratives, what they are and how they differ.
So I think as far as personas go, I would say it generally refers to like your general style and around as you approach it. My brother describes it as, quote, the riz that you give off, quote. So that's his way of looking at it. I think narratives are a bit more specific. They're just the affirmative. Usually it's easier to pull off affirmative, I think, or negative way of just like approaching and theming around. As far as personas go, they're important. There's so many of them, I think. Like if you look at all of the really good debaters, they each have a unique persona. Like, you know, just every single national champion has a different one, and they're unique and good at it. All the other good teams have them as well. Seth and I usually, our personas morph. Like what I said earlier, sometimes even between tournaments and between rounds, there are rounds that we can be very, like, teachery-esque, very slow and methodical. There are rounds where we will try to be very, I don't know, not haughty, but like very, very, very confident in that we know what we're doing and what it's right. And there are also rounds where we're sometimes more chill. Those are the rounds we make jokes. Sometimes we use informal language. So it just depends. And I feel like developing your persona, two things are important. One is just looking up to all the other good personas around you. I just constantly find myself amazed at like the different speakers that do well and how they're all unique and it perfectly suits them. The second thing though is don't like feel tempted to huddle yourself perfectly after someone. Like don't just go to the national YouTube video and be like, oh, I want to be like them, because everyone has their own unique style. And sometimes it takes years. Seth and our styles have taken a good 5 years at this point to fully express themselves. As far as narratives go in a round, this is actually, ironically, one of Seth and our biggest shortcomings, I think, because we are traditionally very line by line, and we just enjoy trying to bully your argument for the sake of, not necessarily impacting it to the rest of the round. That's something we've had to work on this season. Narratives, I think, are important, but again, I'll divide it between F and neg analysis. F should always have a narrative. If there's not something you're consistently impacting it to in every single speech, then this, like, you can win Fs, but they're going to be dramatically less persuasive. So for us this year, our F was dredging primarily. So, I mean, it ran around a couple things, you know, like there's a monopoly right now. We literally can't dredge our own ports, things of that sort of nature. In the past, we've run cases where the narrative doesn't have to be that obvious. So for instance, our terrorism cases, general, like, you don't have to really impact out that supporting terrorism is bad. Or we're in a case about, like, nuclear power plants exploding. Again, you don't really have to impact that a ton, and you don't have to necessarily, like, full send your narrative. But sometimes there are cases where you have to work extra hard to develop them and to make it, especially, like, in heavy numbers cases, economics, to, like, impact that out to the judge in the way that it will affect them in a real life. As far as negative goes, negative is more difficult, I think, particularly when you're negative without a brief. You can run narratives. So for instance, if you're, I don't know, against some arms sales case, you know, your counter negative could be, I don't know, maybe those arms are needed, and so you're going to actually end up killing more civilians, right? If you pull out of a country. That's a fair narrative. But sometimes it's very difficult too. And for Seth and I, the only narrative that we can come up with in certain rounds is just, if we attack our opponents analysis or their evidence or their numbers hard enough, we just run the narrative of you as the judge don't have enough assurance to vote AF. That's kind of what we defaulted back to.
Right. And with debate personas, could you like classify, maybe like generally speaking, different areas of personas? Just like this, I'm not going to try to classify it, but this person does this person does that, that type of persona does that. Do you think that you could just kind of like generalize the best, or like the, of course, everyone has their own style, but they're the personas that you see that do well?
That's a very good question. The reason I say that is because many years ago, Seth and I, no offense, before it got really expensive, Seth and I used to be like avid students over at Ace Peak. And if you know anything about them, you know that they have multiple different persona diamonds. Other people have their own, the ways that they grew a bit. And I think by the time we kind of like moved on from Ace Peak, one of their diamonds had like 24 different like subcategories. And I was like, there's no way. I don't know. Maybe it's a real thing, but I was never like sensitive enough in judging people or like their emotional qualities or the way they came off to really understand how there could be that many. Right. The way that we've generally thought of it is at least the old, somewhat Ace Peak diagram. And I think it's a pretty good way to demonstrate it. And I'd say there's generally four things. There's what they called a rogue, people who are funny, or at least more expressive, more informal. There's people who are teachers, so they generally try to appear the most credible in a room. They're very serious, they're very deliberative in what they say. They read stats, those kinds of things. There's counselors who will sacrifice credibility a little bit in order to be more approachable. So they're trying to just basically walk the judge very slowly through what's going on, make it more clear. And then the last one is a pastor. And those are the people who will also sacrifice some credibility. They'll sacrifice some humorous, I suppose, expressiveness, but replace it with like a gravitas of you have to act now. These are the kinds of cases where it's like forced labor is happening, children are dying, things like that. That's how I've generally looked at it.
Yeah, that's a really good way to think about it. And for you yourself personally, like what persona would you see yourself fitting under, and how did you discover that persona? Because like you mentioned, first of all, you sometimes change like your speaking style depending upon round, but generally speaking, like how did you come about your persona that you find yourself going to most of the time, and what would you classify it as?
It's a good question. I think it, for me, it is largely dependent on my partner, because like I said, Seth and I are very close. We've been doing it 5 years. When we started, we were almost in like our own little persona of just being jerks. Over time, that has changed. So we started off there. Since then, I think we generally are not pastors that much, because the cases that we run, I don't know, most of the time are not like what I view as like fluffy, like people are dying kind of cases. Or if they are, we just don't like make them very sappy. So we don't use pastor that much. Sometimes we will use counselor, but, and try to be more like guiding the judge, being very simplistic and very clear. That's rare. Most of the time we spend our times alternating between being very funny and being very serious. That's where we usually bounce between.
That's cool. I'm still trying to figure out my own persona, so hopefully this can guide me in that direction. Would you say that all of these personas, like the purpose of personas and the way that you deliver, is the purpose or chief goal of them to be more persuasive? Would you say that that's like the purpose of these personas?
I think it depends on which persona you have. Mm-hmm. Rogues, I would say, generally aren't trying to be as persuasive. Or I should say, like, people who are trying to be funny or informal, they're trying to be more winsome. And I think there's a hair of difference between the two. They're very similar, but being winsome. For instance, whenever we're in, sometimes in high out rounds, and we're trying to be funny and whatnot, our goal is not necessarily so much to persuade the judges that, you know, this tiny little detail about our plan is correct. It's to make sure that, like, the audience quite literally is on our side, and there's a very powerful effect there. For, I'm trying to think, for people who are very much like the pastor side of the diagram that we use, yes, absolutely. That's the entire point. This crazy thing is happening. You have to stop it. You know, that's what you can do, Judge. So yes, very, very much tied to persuasiveness value. Counselors, I think, are also less tied to persuasiveness because the goal isn't necessarily to be like, Judge, I'm totally right. I just destroyed my opponent. It's, I'm going to walk you very carefully through a very confusing thing. In the same way that if you have a community judge and they're totally confused because it's some complicated case or somebody explained something wrong, your goal is not necessarily to totally outblast your opponent, I would say, in that scenario, but rather we can squeak by with a win because we very carefully explained it to our judge and we're very simple. So you sacrifice persuasiveness. The last category, though, a teacher, I think, is also as persuasive as a pastor, but for the opposite reason. You're not necessarily trying to overload your judge with, like, an urgency. You're trying to say, I am completely right, or at least largely right, about XYZ issue, and I can give you all of the statistics and all of the analysis, and I've read my history and done my book research and all those things. So, yes, I'd say it's also very tied to persuasiveness.
How would you define persuasiveness?
It's a very difficult question because it was difficult for everyone.
Right.
I think persuasiveness, at least in a team policy scenario, is just trying to, I think, get the judge to accept that what you're saying is true. But also, and this is where winsomeness comes in because it's important, a judge can accept that what you're saying is true or at least largely agree with you. But if they don't, like, vibe with you for whatever reason, maybe you're rude in the round, maybe I don't know what happened, right? That's happened to us before when, like, especially back in our early days. If you're not winsome on top of that and the judge doesn't want to vote from you, that's how I would define winsomeness, you have to have both. So I think that's how I define the two. I think they're both critical.
Yeah. So as per that definition, is there ever a time when you would want to sacrifice persuasiveness for something else?
I think, again, it goes back to those personas. Right. There are certain personas and subcategories of those personas where, yes, you will. If you're trying to be really funny because you're trying to be more winsome, you'll sacrifice persuasiveness because no one is going to take you as seriously after that cross-examination laughter. But, you know, hopefully it may erase a mistake that you made, or people will just be like, yo, that's cool. I'm now vibing with him. And maybe down the road, you'll be more persuasive. If you're, again, being more comforting to your judge and very, you know, methodical in how you're explaining it, you're going to sacrifice some of the rah, 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 we've got to act now, or the, you know, I'm uber right about everything, but you may come out with a win because they actually understand you. So I think there are situations where it's acceptable. You just have to play it with your opponents and, you know, play it by ear with how the judge is reacting.
Yeah, great. Well, as for narratives, is narratives something that you would adopt as your viewpoint for the entire debate round and you would remain consistent with it? Or is it something that's more speech specific?
This is a very good question. I think yes and yes. Sometimes you have to have a narrative, particularly I think when you're affirmative, your narrative better be consistent the entire round.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you and your partner are doing different narratives, that you can emphasize different things, and that's fair, but if you aren't emphasizing like the same harms and that we have the proper solution, you're kind of going to have a difficult trouble. As far as negative, if your partner's arguments, like your one in and your two in, are both complementary, then yes, run the same narrative. But sometimes what Seth and I will do is we will run sometimes outright contradictory arguments, and we're just doing an even if situation for the judge. And then we'll run different narratives. And you know, you just got to be careful to explain that. Otherwise, no, your opponents will say you're contradicting. So I would say it kind of depends. The one thing I would say, though, about narratives and adhering to them is to be flexible at times. Because I watched around many, many years ago where this was where both teams back in our region in those days, there was the goals in your 1ACs and your 1NCs. You know, and we had these, you know, formal goals. It was the terrorism year, so the affirmative proposed a goal of national security, I think it was. And then negative proposed the goal of, like, the U.S.'s national interests. Most people can see that those are very similar, if not and this. In the situation of fighting terrorism, like, the exact same thing. But I kid you not, they both ran these narratives and literally spent like 2 to 3 minutes of each of their speeches arguing over the narratives, even though they were identical. And what was really funny was by the time the round was over, they had both agreed that the narratives were identical. The goals were identical in this case. And they acted as if, like, duh, of course they're the same. So it was so funny. So I would just say to be careful and be flexible if your goal needs to shift in the round or how you approach it.
Yeah. So with narratives, is narratives like the kind of like the magnifying lens in which you view the round, of course, like you just said, like there's exceptions to it depending upon the speech and all that. But again, like generally speaking, narratives as a concept, is this kind of how you begin the speech, or not necessarily begin the speech, but how you start framing the other side as, and that's what you want to remain consistent in, and that's what you want to be complimentary with towards your partner and all that. And that's essentially the essence of narratives.
Yeah, I say that's well said. It's also, I think, framing your own side too as the counter to their side. And in short, like, at least the way I understand it, it's also just something as simple as a theme.
Yeah. Now, before we close, I have one final question. So how would you say you can create like a clear narrative, or a narrative that just doesn't feel out of place? How do you make it feel much more natural in the debate round?
That's a good question. I would say I'll again divide my analysis between affirmative and negative. Your narrative as affirmative is partially going to depend on what the pull is of your case and what the focus is. It's going to depend on how good the affirmative case is, right? If it's a poor case, it's going to have a poor narrative. Or at least, it'll have a narrative, but it's not that persuasive. So, I think the narrative on the affirmative, for one, figure out what kind of case you're running. If it's a case that, for instance, this year, like, is like something like forced labor or the pesticides case, the narrative there is going to be much different than someone who's, I don't know, running a case about like sneaker tariffs, right? Like the Arianis did. There's going to be different narratives there and how you approach those. Or a case that's like really, really boring and it's just super dry. For us, our narratives depends, for at least dredging this year, it kind of depended on two things. One is it depended on the fact that our case was kind of, it was different than a lot of other cases, and that was kind of like a, someone described it as like a down-home case. It actually dealt with something that was like, you could kind of see, especially if you live near the coastal areas of the United States. You know, like ports are clogged. The other thing, though, as far as developing the narrative, is it depends on your rhetoric that you develop in the round. Because a narrative, if proper, has to be implemented through every speech, as you know. So you have to have accompanying rhetoric that fills that and links the two. Seth and I have always found that our narratives or mantras, themes, whatever you want to call it, get better as the season goes on. The very first tournament that we run a case, there's no narrative behind it because we haven't developed all those, you know, fancy little rhetorical phrases about how bad it is or, you know, whatever. That's part of developing it and just becoming comfortable with it. And I've literally spent like my off times this season walking around the lake on our farm and just practicing it out. And just thinking of different neat little rhetorical things, and Seth would think of his own and stuff like that. As far as negative, developing a narrative kind of depends on how much preparation you have against the case. Obviously, your narrative is going to be something that you think of in prep time, if you think of it at all, if you're without a brief, right? So you may have much less persuasive of a narrative. In our case, in some cases, like as I was telling you earlier, when Seth and I were neck without a brief and all we were doing was just attacking details, our narrative, not much to it, other than we would just kind of default to framing it as, you, the judge, do not have assurance to vote F. You know, especially if we pair that with some sort of likelihood of a disadvantage. Or there's times where you have a very well thought out brief that you've planned, you're eager to hit this case. In that case, I would also kind of do the same thing as I was saying for affirmatives. Spend just conscious time thinking through rhetorical bits and pieces that will support that. Practice it so that the 1NC or the 2NC or etc. that you give in a round against that case, especially if you know a lot about it, they're in your region, etc., make sure that the speech that you give isn't actually the first time you've given it, and that'll help.
That's true. Well, Thank you so much for all of your valuable insights today, Caleb. I really appreciate all the time that you took and discussing these things with me. I definitely learned a lot, and I hope that anyone listening learned a lot as well. So thank you for your time, Caleb.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thanks for listening to this episode.
I would really appreciate it if you could rate or follow this podcast. It really does go a long way.
If you have any comments, suggestions, questions, or just want to keep up to date, you can follow my Instagram at onpointpodcast_. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next one.